Christ alone.
Excuse me.
This week's portion is the final portion in the Torah cycle. It's not officially on the calendar because they don't do it on the Shabbat. They do it during the week, which makes no sense whatsoever. But this is the final portion. It's Vezot HaBaracha. It means, and this is the blessing. It's Deuteronomy 33:1 through 34:12. The Haftorah portion is Joshua 1:1 through 18. And the Avostok scripture portion is Jude 1:9. So next week begins the Torah cycle all over again. Back to Bereshit. This week we end it. So the introduction. After concluding his final blessing on Israel, Moses ascends Mount Nebo. Before dying, he gazes on the promised land as the Lord shows him the land he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In it, he sees Israel and the way it will shape the history of all humanity. Then he dies by the hand of God at the age of 120 years. His eyes undimmed and his vigor unabated. A true man of God, whom God knew face to face. Deuteronomy 34:5-12. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no man knows his burial place to this day. Although Moses was 120 years old when he died, his eye was not dim, nor his vigor abated. So the sons of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. And the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Since that time, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. For all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants, and all his land, and for all the mighty power and for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. It's interesting, in the first verse, in 5, it says, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. The Hebrew word that's used there is the word peh. The word peh translates as mouth. So it says according to the word of the Lord, but actually it should be according to the mouth of the Lord. So in other words, the Lord spoke forth, Moses died. Took Moses' life from him. It's kind of a sad ending when you think about it, to a life that he spends all this time and he's not allowed to enter into a land, but to the promised land, because he made one mistake. In 40 years of dealing with Israel, he makes one mistake. But God holds leaders to a higher level of accountability. And Moses, being the leader that he was probably held to the highest level of accountability that you could be held. Because he was the one that God called out to free the Hebrews from the land of Egypt, to bring them into the wilderness, and then to make them into a nation. And it took 40 years. And the reason it took 40 years was because that was what the Lord decreed would happen, because of the 40 days that the 12 spies spent in the land, the land of Canaan. Sad thing about it is that because they spent 40 days there, it was 1 year for each one of those. So it was 40 years that they would be. But the other thing that comes out of it is it took 40 years for that generation, 20 years of age and up, who came out of Egypt to die. Took them all that time to pass away. And the last one of that generation would be Moses. Only two make it in out of that generation, and that is Joshua and Caleb. Joshua becomes the next leader It's funny because Moses is from the tribe of Levi. Joshua is from the tribe of Ephraim. And yet, later on, when the kingship comes into play, it's given in to the tribe of Judah. Later on in the history of Israel, during the time of the Maccabees were priests. They were from the tribe of Levi, from the line of Aaron. They not only had the priesthood, they also became the kings. That was out of sync with what Torah commanded. And once again, it would be proven that no matter how righteous you want to call them, or how they started out their kingship or their dynasty or whatever, that when you read the history of the Maccabees, that degenerated down until finally the final one of that generation passed away and was killed and removed from there. It's the same history that we're going to see, we saw throughout Israel. Israel started out on a high note and Israel went down on a low note. Or maybe I should, maybe Israel started out on a low note, really. They came out of Egypt, went into the wilderness, and immediately went into sin. Their sin was continuous disobedience against God, but their first great sin was making a golden calf. Or I should say, persuading Aaron to make the golden calf. Aaron, the first high priest of Israel. Was that kind of setting a tone for future failure of that? Or was that a redemptive process for Aaron? Because he would have to be the one who would have to bear Israel in front of the Lord every Yom Kippur. So for all the time that he would serve as the high priest of Israel, he would have to go in once a year into the Holy of Holies, bearing the sins of Israel before God. I think probably in some way, you know, you might think that God has his own sense of humor in how he arranges things. But at the same time, God also had a purpose in mind for Aaron to have to do this, to show him what he had done that he had given in too easily to the people. He compounded his sin by lying to Moses. When he's asked about where did the golden calf come from, Aaron readily replies, it jumped out of the fire. Woo, it jumped out of the fire. Like he would believe that his brother would believe that? It was kind of interesting. God sends him down from the mountain. He says, you need to get back down to the camp because of what's going on there. And as he's coming down, I don't know how far he came down, but Joshua was waiting for him. Because Joshua went up with him so far, stopped, and just waited there while he was up on the mountain. And when he came down, Joshua said to him, I don't know what's going on down there in the camp or whatever. Moses, I know what's going on. They go down to the camp, and of course, that's where they find him. And that begins a pattern of the fact of Israelites having to die for their sin. And it should be, but it's not a warning. You know, people don't take it at the face value that it is because they don't see God killing people today. Not in that number over and over without connecting it. But maybe God is still rendering judgment on people today. We just are not paying attention to it because he's using natural phenomena that we would call natural phenomena in order to accomplish his purpose. You think about that and how things are going and what's happening. And the more and more that we start paying attention, we start seeing things happening, I believe that we're going to see the hand of God more and more and more in rendering. Not only, God is on the one hand is going to pull back his protection, but on the other hand, he's going to render his judgment. And then on the flip side of that, he's going to free Satan up even more to do what he's been doing. So it's going to be a picture of what's to come in the ultimate battle between God and man. And God and Satan. Because that final battle is going to take place between Messiah, the Son of God, and Satan, a fallen angel. And one who rebelled against God. And that is going to be a battle for the ages when you think about that. It's kind of interesting because God demonstrates that he has power over Satan and that he can control Satan when he sends the archangel Michael to bind Satan and throw him into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. So he shows that he has that power over him. And that it's very easy for God to control Satan. And I'm sure Satan is not too pleased about that. But Satan, with his lying tongue, is going to continue to try to persuade God that mankind isn't worth all this effort that he's expending upon it. But God knows better because God created us. He used Messiah to create us, and he wouldn't have done that because he knew what we would do before we even did it. He knew how it was all going to turn out. He knew it was a necessity, everything that was going to happen. Because he knew it, he could see it all. He could see it all unfold before him. Wouldn't that be something to have that kind of foresight? But then again, maybe you don't really want to have that because you don't want to see what's going to happen at the end. In Deuteronomy 34, 5 through 12, I already read that part. So, it always amazes me too. Moses is 120 years old. And it tells us in there, his eyesight was still fine. And apparently his had no fatigue level whatsoever and no aches and pains. So the cure to old age could be found in Moses' relationship with God, telling us that if we spend enough time in the presence of God, we can have the same side effects that Moses got from it. Moses came down off the mountain and his face was glowing from being in the presence of God. The people saw it and they were afraid of him. So what did he do? He put a veil over his face to cover the glow of that. If the people were smart, they would have allowed him to walk around with his face unveiled, and they could have drawn in some of that. But then again, maybe God didn't want them to have any of that. Because he didn't want them to keep on going. But the thing about it is that eventually, we will be able to be in the presence of the Father and the Son in that same power that Moses was able to be in. And we will be able to be fed by God. Think about that. Being fed by God. How many times did Yeshua teach that he was the water of life? He was the bread of life. He could give us everything that we needed and we would not hunger anymore. He could do all of that. And one day we will be in the presence of God. And maybe then we won't need these things, that we will be fed by God himself. I'm looking forward to that. You know, this world is one thing, but I'd rather see the world to come. I'd rather see what God has in store for us. We get little pictures of it when we read the Bible, but I don't really think we can get the full grasp and the full picture of what God has in store for us. That the blessings that he wants to pour out on his children. Moses passes away. God buries him. God, has God ever buried any other individual? He didn't even bury his own son. His own son was buried by man because it had to be done that way because of prophecy. But Moses is buried by God. Moses is killed by God. We don't know how God accomplished what he did to Moses. Somehow I believe that he just took away that spirit that was within him, that spirit of life that was thriving within him, and Moses just passed away. And he buried him. But he buried him where nobody would know where he was at. Why did God do that? Personally, I believe that the reason that he did that was he didn't want the people to turn Moses' burial place into a shrine. He didn't want them to come and start worshiping Moses and lose sight about keeping focused on God and their relationship with him. I mean, come on. People today worship all kinds of things. I don't know if many people are familiar with the fact that within ultra-Orthodox Judaism, in their practice of Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism, they believe that they can commune with dead rabbis. They have a practice where they go to the cemeteries where these famous rabbis are buried, and they lay on their graves, and they believe that they can spirit to spirit connect with them. That's just as bad, if not, you know, worse than what some people in the church do when they worship idols or saints. How can a saint intercede on your behalf between you and God when God says that the only way you can come to him is through his son? How many people try to attain a relationship with God by trying to go to the mother of Yeshua and use her to somehow influence her son? I mean, come on, that's kind of twisted thinking. Our relationship with God is direct. It's direct through Messiah. He's our intermediary. That's the whole picture of the high priest in the sacrificial system. His job was to intercede on our behalf between us and God. That was his responsibility. He was the only one who could go into the Holy of Holies once a year to intercede on our behalf with God. The only one, a picture of Messiah, who intercedes on our behalf. Right now, he's interceding on our behalf. He is at the right hand of the Father right now. He's waiting for the Father to release him to come back again. But in that intermediary time, he is interceding on our behalf. So we need to pray to him to intercede with the Father. Now, even the Hebrews, the Jewish people are going to tell you that they have a direct connection to God. They don't need any intermediaries. If they understood their own system, they would know that an intermediary is required, because why do you think you had a high priest? It's always interesting in the synagogue, the practice is that they give out in the larger synagogue 7 readings on the Shabbat. And the first reading is to go to a Levite from the line of Aaron, a priest. Then the next one would go to a Levite who served the priesthood. And then after that, it was the regular people. That's the way the system was set up. But then you hear them tell you that the reason that they don't need Messiah, they don't need Yeshua, is because they can go directly to God. They show a lack of understanding of their own history and the way that God set up the system. He's always required an intermediary. Moses was an intermediary between Israel and God. Aaron became the high priest. God was dividing the leadership of the nation into 2 parts. You would have your leader on the one part, and you would have your priest on the other side. Later on, it would become the kings. Moses, for all intents and purposes, and so was Joshua, they were actually kings. But they didn't have that formal title. But then again, they also had the power that God gave to them that was greater than any king that ever ruled in Israel. Greater than even David. David didn't have the power that Moses did. Moses was as close to being a righteous man as you could get, except he missed the last percent. So would that mean that Moses was a failure in that? No, Moses wasn't a failure in that because Moses appears on the Mount of Transfiguration in the Apostolic Scriptures with the prophet Elijah to speak to Yeshua. And what does the scripture tell us about what the discussion was? They were discussing what he was going to be encountering and going through. Like they needed to come and really discuss that with him? Simon wakes up in the middle of that discussion and he probably kind of his eyes in that bright light and everything that was there because he saw Messiah in his glory that he was there. He immediately thought that it was probably the fulfillment of Sukkot, and he said, we need to build sukkahs for you so we can house all three of you there, you know, the guests and all of those things. He was out of timing. His timing was off with that. He didn't have it correct at that point. But the important part of that thing was that Moses was there in the land on the mountain, finally made it in. God brought him in. The other thing was that God kills Moses in his physical body, but yet later we see him spiritually alive with God. Most people, when they die, will lay in the grave until they're resurrected. But God can choose the individuals that he wants to be with him for whatever reason that he wants to. Some people, they say that, well, it says in Scripture that, you know, when you die, you'll be in the presence of Messiah and in the presence of God. It's not a guarantee when you die. Death in Scripture is equated with being asleep. So the thing is that when you die, if that's supposed to be a form of sleep, well, every night that we go to sleep, we're not sure if we're going to wake up the next day. I mean, that's the reality. Think about it. You go to sleep, do you really know that you're going to get up the next day? So, if you go to sleep when you die, you don't know how long you're going to be asleep in there, and then when you wake up the next time, you'll be in the presence of God. So it doesn't matter how much time that you spend in the ground, God's going to bring you back. Except it's going to be a better place that he's going to bring us to than the place it is now. You know, it's kind of interesting, all the news shows that you watch these days and everything that you see on there. They keep talking about the United States and how it's on a downhill slide. And the thing that they keep talking about is that its age as a republic is getting up there. And when republics get to that age, like Rome and Greece and all of that, it runs its life cycle out. And it's done, and it's time for something new to come up in its place. God knows the way that this world is going, we need something new. Because what they want to replace everything with here now is not going to be any better. It's going to be downhill, people. It's going to be a time that we're alive that we need to hold on to God and hold Him tighter than we've ever done before. And if you don't hold close to God, and if you walk away from your faith in God, God's going to break faith with you. God's not going to chase after you. God's presented you with the truth, and now it's up to you to decide what you're going to do with it. Joshua knew what the truth was, and he kept faith with God. Caleb knew what the truth was, and he kept faith with God. And both of them were rewarded. They were allowed to go into the land. But did they have a complete time of peace when they were in the land? No. They fought almost the entire time that they were in the land during the lifespan of Joshua until Joshua finally said, I'm too old to continue on. I can't do it any longer. And they stopped. They didn't continue on after that, so they never possessed all of the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God had told Abraham, wherever your foot goes, wherever your foot steps, that is yours. So he wandered from one part of the promised land to the other part of the promised land. He went back and forth. It didn't mean he was constantly on the move. He would stop for a while in the different places, graze his flocks and everything that he needed to do. Every place that he went, he became wealthier and more important. And people saw that he was being blessed. They saw that something was different about him. In Joshua 1:16 through 18, it says, "And they answered Joshua, 'All that you have commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your words, whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous.'" So the people responded back to Joshua in an affirmation of accepting him as the new leader of Israel and to lead the people into the land. And it's kind of interesting, in verse 17 it says, "Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you." We have to remember this is the new generation. So maybe they were better at obedience than the old generation was. But I kind of find that humorous, that "just as we obeyed Moses in all things." I wonder if Joshua immediately was thinking, "Oh God, I really hope that this is a brand new generation and not the one that I witnessed for 40 years in the wilderness." And you notice that they say, "Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your words, whatever you command him shall be put to death." And then they tell him, "Only be strong and courageous." They tell him in the beginning, "Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses." They want to make sure that Joshua is doing God's will, that God is in control. I don't know how they couldn't see that, because they were there when Moses commissioned him, when Moses set him apart by laying his hands on him, and God had instructed Moses to give him some of his spirit. He didn't give him all of his spirit. He only gave him some of it. But yet that was enough that the people would know that Joshua had been called out by God and was the successor to Moses. Moses never chose Joshua. Moses said to God, "You choose the man that you want to lead Israel." That's the way it was always supposed to be. God was to choose the leader of Israel. The people were not to choose the leader of Israel. The leaders of Israel were not to choose themselves. But the kings of Israel, the first thing that Saul thought about was that David is going to take the throne if we don't kill him, he tells Jonathan, his son. And Jonathan, who's this tight with David, is disappointed in his father. And then he talks back to his father and he tells his father, "How can he do that? How can he treat him that way?" And Saul's response is that he's going to destroy our dynasty. He doesn't have a dynasty. So he relinquishes the control that he's supposed to have. But we always have to remember one thing about Saul. Even though God chose him, he chose and gave to Israel the king that they wanted. That they wanted. What was their what did they say to Samuel? They said, "We want a king like the nations." And they got a king like the nations. And slowly but surely Saul went downhill. And then that repeats itself in the kingship of Israel. David, who God chose, was not perfect. He had many imperfections. But he was a man that God chose. He was a man who would acknowledge his sin. The unfortunate thing was he acknowledged how to keep acknowledging his sins over and over and over again, because he kept repeating his sins over and over and over again. But that sets the tone for us. We're in the same way. And the only way out of that is through Messiah. In Joshua 5:13-15, "One day when Yehoshua was there by Jericho, he raised his eyes and looked, and in front of him stood a man with his drawn sword in his hand. Yehoshua went over him and asked him, "Are you on our side or on the side of our enemy?" "No," he replied, "but I am the commander of Adonai's army. I have come just now." Yehoshua fell down with his face to the ground and worshipped him, then asked, "What does my Lord have to say to his servant?" The commander of Adonai's army answered Yehoshua, "Take your sandals off your feet, because the place where you are standing is holy." And Yehoshua did so. Who's the commander of the Lord's army? Yehoshua. Actually, Yeshua's name in Hebrew was Yehoshua. He would have been Joshua in the English. Yeshua, even though they brought it into the Hebrew language, is actually from the Aramaic. So the interesting thing about it here is that he sees a man standing there with a sword drawn in his hand, and it's kind of interesting. He goes over to him and asks him, "Are you on our side or on the side of our enemies?" That's one guy with chutzpah. He definitely wasn't afraid, you know? And the reply he gets, "No, but I am the commander of the Lord's army." So what does Joshua do? He fell down on his face to the ground and he worshipped him. So was this an angel of the Lord that was standing there? No, this was the Messiah that was standing there. So here you have a pre-incarnate revelation of Messiah to Joshua. And what is the commander of the Lord's army response to Joshua? He says, "Take your sandals off your feet, because the place where you are standing is holy." What does that give us a picture of? Right back to Moses and the burning bush. Because what was Moses taught? Take the sandals off of your feet, because the ground that you're standing on is holy ground. That's Exodus 3:5. The connection. Joshua to Moses. Moses into that first encounter with God. And Joshua, his encounter with God. It was an affirmation for Joshua of what he had been called to do, and that the Lord was going to come and he would fight for him as long as they would stand up and fight for themselves. And Israel would do that for as long as Joshua could lead them. In Joshua 4:14, "On that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life." Joshua led them and helped them in their first conquest in the land, was to take down the city of Jericho. And you would think that the way that they did it, that the people behind the walls were probably laughing. You know, marching around the city, blowing shofars or trumpets or whatever they were blowing. It didn't matter. They might have even blown both. But they're doing all of this, and they're marching around, and then they take a break and go away for that. And they do it for X number of days, and then on the final day they go around and they just blast it out. And what happens? The walls come tumbling down. Yes, I know there's an old song to that. Yes, I've heard it. That's there. Don't start singing it. The walls came tumbling down and the army went in and they took Jericho. And they spared Rahab and anyone who was in her house. Why? Because she had protected the two spies that they sent in to the land. I remember her story is a great story that's in there, because her response to them is that we know that your God is with you, because we know what your God did to Egypt. This is 40 years later. What happened to Egypt is still fresh in the mind of people. And can you imagine the people there in the city of Jericho just opposite on the other side of the Jordan, here is the army of Israel, here is the nation of Israel, all prepared to come over into the land, and who's the first place in their way? Their intention was not to go around the city. Their intention was to go over the city. God's intention was to bring it down, to set an example, to build up Israel and build up their faith, but also to show the nations living in the land of Canaan that their time was due. And Jude 1:9 says, "And when the archangel Michael, contending with the devil, was disputing about the body of Moses, he did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous judgment, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" Isn't that an interesting response? How many times have I heard people praying over the years? They go into these long, drawn-out prayers against Satan and going to do this and God do that and God blah, 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 blah. And here's an archangel. He's Michael. He's disputing with the devil, with Satan, over the body of Moses. But he hasn't come against him by cursing him, by spouting out all of this self-righteous stuff and everything like that. He simply says, "The Lord rebuke you. The Lord rebuke you." That's the only thing we need. All you need is God. All you need is faith in Messiah. All you need to do is abide in His covenant. You've got everything that you need. You don't need anything else. You've got the power of God behind you. You've got the power of God that's willing to help you to do what you need to do. You have the power of God to help see you through the trials that God Himself is going to launch against you to test you. But God will see you through that if you hold fast to your faith in Him. That's the whole story about Israel. That's the whole story here that we're seeing. God was with Israel as long as Israel would stand up and fight for themselves. Are you willing to fight for yourself? I can't imagine Moses' relationship with God. He spent 40 years learning directly from God Himself. Directly from the author of the Torah. He was taught by God. He learned. And he applied it in life, and then he took what he learned and he taught it to the children of Israel. And then for them to remember him for every generation after that, near the end of his life, he wrote down the Torah into a book and he gave it into the custody of the priest, and he told them to place this alongside the Ark of the Covenant. You notice he didn't say place it on the inside of the Ark of the Covenant. Why? Because they needed that book of the Torah on the outside, because they needed to live their lives by that. And whatever was in the ark, the two stone tablets, the rod of Aaron, and a jar of manna, that was never going to be taken out of the ark. It would remain within the ark. The Torah was not meant to remain within the ark. The Torah was meant to be on the outside to teach us. To teach us about having a covenant relationship with God, but even more importantly, it was to teach us about our redemption through Messiah. Everywhere I read throughout the Torah, throughout the Tanakh, I see Messiah. He walks through those pages. He's there, and He's waiting for us. I don't need the New Testament to show me the Messiah. 2,000 years ago, they did not have a New Testament. So everyone that came to faith in Messiah did it by the witness of the disciples, but also did it through the testimony of Torah. What did Yeshua say about Himself? He said about Himself that the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms, they testify of me. Or I think it's just the Torah and the Psalms he actually refers to. But it's all in there. They all testify of Messiah. But 2,000 years ago, they didn't need another Bible. wasn't necessary. Some people like to talk about that the Tanakh, or the Old Testament as they unfortunately refer to it, is Messiah hidden, and that the New Testament is Messiah revealed. He's revealed in the pages of the Torah over and over and over again. And we see his redemptive aspect, and we see his kingly aspect, and we see the power that he has and what he's willing to do. Next week, we begin all over again with Bereshit in the beginning when he created everything. Isn't that power? He created out of nothing. He thought it and it came into being. We would like to think that we could do that, but we can't. We are not gods, no matter what anybody might tell you. We are not even little gods. We are not even tiny gods. We are people, human beings created by God with a life expectancy of whatever he deems when he wants us to die. But he also gives us a promise that if we abide by faith in him, we will have life everlasting. And I'm going to close with this. Torah Man says, there has never been a statue erected to the memory of someone who left well enough alone. Can you imagine how things would have turned out if God just said to Moses, when Moses protested wanting to follow him and do what he was told to do, if he just said to Moses, "All right, Moses, I don't want to hear any more complaining and arguing from you. Go get out of here." Would that have been the end of the story? Would God have gone out and found somebody else, or does the Bible stop there? No, it doesn't. God wouldn't take no for an answer. He had called Moses out, and Moses would go and do what God wanted him to do.